I use the word Big Bang to actually refer to the supposed origin of the universe, like the first moment. And this is what we get if we take Einstein's theories and the current expansion and we just extrapolate the equations backwards. There's the first moment in time where everything started, and this is what we call the Big Bang. But we don't have data, observations going that far back.
Just to bring in Sabina again, and on this idea of unifying them in the theory of everything, just to push you on how hopeful you are of us, you know, arriving at a big theory of everything. I know you've made some. I saw a quotation in our research where you said science cannot make any statements about the existence of something we can't observe. May that be gods or other universes. And I imagine there might be some things in our theory of everything that we sort of can't observe. So is it always going to be beyond the horizon?
That we can't observe yet. So certainly if you have a theory of everything, you wanted to make some predictions that we can test, that being the big problem with string theory, right? It doesn't make any testable predictions. So let me distinguish between two things. You made a very good distinction. There's this difference between trying to quantize gravity and trying to find the theory of all the interactions within the same framework. And then physicists also often conflate two other things, which is that we might be finding this unified description of all the fundamental forces, and it might be a final theory in the sense that this is the theory of everything and it's this unified one, whatever. Or it might just be a theory of the four fundamental interaction and then there's more stuff beyond it.
Yeah.
So personally, I don't think that even if we manage to unify all those four interactions, that it'll be a final theory.
Okay.
So and
what
I'm
sort of stuff
somewhat
will be left out.
We don't know. Like there's something left to find. For example, I mean, there's a measurement problem in quantum mechanics that Yvette already mentioned, which is usually totally left out of this entire discussion, quantum gravity. Except by Roger Penrose, who's trying to solve the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. But he's not really trying to quantize gravity. So those are two different things, and I think they shouldn't be. Like there's got to be more than that.
I wondered that you're saying, you know, if the unobservable, you know, it's hard to make statements about that, and you give the multiverse as an example. I wondered, I think the Big Bang was sort of mentioned earlier. Is that something we can make meaningful statements about from the perspective of science, given we can't, you know, observe it, be there?
Depends on what you mean by meaningful. I'm sorry, I do start to sound
can
like John.
Can it fall into our theory of everything?
Well, you know, it's meaningful to some people, right? I mean, some people care a lot about the beginning of the universe. Personally, I'm not one of them. But just to stick with Roger Penrose, right? He has this idea of the, what's it called, the cosmological cyclic conformal cosmology. And certainly it's meaningful to him. So my personal perspective on all these theories about the beginning of the universe is that we don't have the data to support them.
Right.
It's more about storytelling than it is about science. There are all kinds of different stories that we can make up, to try to explain what happened there. And I personally don't think that we'll ever have the data to explain what happened at the Big Bang. It's just an area where we can't look and we'll never be able to. I think it's one of the ways that science is fundamentally limited.
So just so I'm clear, I'm just trying to figure this out in my head for the first time. The Big Bang is a story that we sort of tell ourselves about the beginning of the world, but it's not something which an appropriate scientific methodology can make predictions about given the data set that we have. We can't say that the Big Bang is a scientific sort of fact.
So one of the problems here is that people have used the word Big Bang to mean different things. So maybe I should first sort this out. Some people use the word Big Bang just to refer to the expansion of the universe.
Yeah.
This is not what I mean. I use the word Big Bang to actually refer to the supposed origin of the universe, like the first moment. And this is what we get if we take Einstein's theories and the current expansion and we just extrapolate the equations backwards. That's the first moment in time where everything started, and this is what we call the Big Bang. But we don't have data, observations going that far back. So we now have the James Webb Space Telescope, which observes the earliest galaxies, but those are still like 100, 200 million years after the Big Bang. And then we have the cosmic microwave background, which was like 300,000 years after the Big Bang. And before this, we have math. That's it. And this is why I say we can make up a lot of stories for these earlier times, and they will all fit to the data because we just can't measure what happened earlier. A philosopher would say these theories are strongly underdetermined.
Okay.
Did I get this right?
I think so. I mean, I wouldn't pretend to know. But what they might say about it, I can't imagine. I'm still struggling. I want to come back to this in a moment. But I think James perhaps has a view very similar to what you're saying there, that it might, you think from your opening remarks, you know, our descriptions of the world, they're not really of the essences of things. We're sort of describing the relations, what they sort of do. And so you can have multiple stories about something like the Big Bang in a theory of everything. Lots of different ways of explaining the same sort of thing, the same sort of relation.
Sure. I mean, I think what was said, I agree with it, that science is about tying our speculation to empirical observation. And when we're sort of forging ahead and trying to develop new science, we might be in a period where we're speculating and we've gone beyond what we can currently empirically investigate. And it's not that we shouldn't do that, but we should recognize that that's a stage that we're on when we're trying to get testable science, but we shouldn't mistake it for knowledge. And you know, there's a lot of what's said about the origin of the universe that's not confirmed or testable, or, and it's really, you know, the Big Bang really refers to the period of time that wasn't very long when the universe was very, very hot and very, very dense. I mean, that's a kind of scientifically respectable notion of the Big Bang, I think. But the idea of like a first moment or something, not even obvious it's coherent. I mean, I think what's interesting about the world in general, when we think about like the whole world, but things in the world, is that they often look very different at different scales, and we often, something that seems like a one at another scale seems like a many. I think the important thing is not like, is it really a one or is it really a many? The important thing is, okay, what purposes and predictions and manipulations and so on are facilitated by thinking of it one way and what another? So for many purposes, it's going to suit me to think of the table as a one because it's an object at my scale, you know, the relevant time scales and so on. But if I wanted to understand the constitution of the table, then I should no longer think of it as a one. I should think of it as the crystal lattice of the silicon or whatever that's forming the glass that's making the table. And if someone says, yeah, but is it really a one or a many? I feel like, well, I'm not sure what hangs on that.
Well, I think that some questions that we've been trying to answer by reductionism, what we do in physics that works super well, is that we break things into little parts, maybe particles or maybe fields or something else. But then we try to put the pieces of the puzzle together to explain something else. And well, I mean, we have lasers and a lot of things we've done by doing that. Obviously it works, but there might be, I'm just saying, like, there might be other things that cannot be explained in that way. So the thing that comes to my mind is consciousness, for example, right? So in the materialistic point of view, we think that atoms and fields and all of this is fundamental. And then we should be able to explain what consciousness is from that. And then there's the famous problem of consciousness that David Chalmers points out. Then Roger Penrose thinks that where quantum mechanics and general relativity go wrong. I mean, no, he thinks that we need to find that extra theory. And then when we'll find this extra theory, then we will be able to explain what consciousness is. But I don't know, maybe I don't exactly see why. Again, because I think that unifying quantum theory and general relativity is just going to tell us a little bit about the physical world and so on. And I'm not sure it will say something about what's life and what is consciousness. It might be that we'll have to turn the whole picture around and consider other options. And I tell you why I think that could be the case. When we were trying to explain like the trajectories of planets, humans at the time used to think that, or the people working on these problems, that the circle had to be used because it's a perfect figure. So then planets have to follow circles, and then there was the epicycles. No, it doesn't work with one circle, then one circle within another. And so you needed 600 circles in order to explain that. And then, okay, well, that Kepler shows us that they're not circles, it's an ellipse, and there's that some beauty there in this elegance and so on. But sometimes we hold on to ideas really strongly that are just wrong. And once we let go and we change the paradigm, then we can find solutions to that. So maybe turning the thing around from starting from the one and going into the other way around could be possible solutions to problems like that one.
Well, returning to the start of the debate and sort of the pretext of it, thinking back to the ancient Greeks and thinking of their views of what the one and the many might look like, and you're introducing consciousness here. The view seemed to be there something like, you could have a theory of everything, could be purely materialistic, to take your word, and consciousness would still fall out of that. Sabina, I know you once said that materialism is a word that people use on Twitter who don't know what they're talking about. And I wonder, is this a case of that, or do you think that if you had a purely physicalist, you know, complete account that physics can give you of the world, would that still fall out of the theory of everything?
Theoretically, it's called a theory of everything because theoretically it describes everything in the universe. In practice, we almost certainly won't be able to actually do the calculations. Mm. But I want to pick up on something which you just said in the passing, which I think is very important. You said that maybe reductionism isn't going to get us any further.
No.
So, well, it might be
further in many ways, but not in that. I mean, I think reductionism is always going to take us further. We've seen that, and I don't think that's going to stop. But maybe it's not the only way to solve some other problems that, you know.
I was about to agree with you.
Okay, so, sorry.
I just wanted to.
Oh, I wanted to some side
here. I just want to say that depends on what you mean by reductionism. So basically, there are two different ways that we use the word. One is to say so if we can derive one theory from another theory, then we say we have reduced it to something else. Like, for example, you could say, like, the theory for the constituents of the atomic nuclei, we can derive this at least in principle from the theory of the constituents of those particles, like quarks and gluons, and so on. So the more fundamental theory is the standard model of particle physics, whereas the other theory can be reduced to that. And the other sense in which we use the word is that we go to shorter scales, right? So we have atomic nuclei, and then the quarks are smaller, and they kind of sit inside of them, and then we have lots of gluons and so on and so forth. And now, historically, the interesting thing is that those two things have gone hand in hand. So when we went to shorter distance scales, we also got more fundamental theories. And it might just be that those things no longer go hand in hand. We might actually find a more fundamental theory by going to larger scales again. And I actually think that Roger Penrose's idea of the gravitationally induced collapse hints at something like that. Because if you're talking about the collapse of the wave function, you're necessarily talking about what happens in a measurement. But a measurement is done by a detector, which is a fairly big device. So we're actually going to larger systems again, and not to shorter scales.
Okay. James, your thoughts on this and maybe consciousness?
Yeah, I think that's very helpful, that distinction you made, because, I mean, if I just repeat what you said and then add to it, that there's reduction in the sense of reducing things to the parts and their interactions, and then there's reduction in the sense of reducing things to smaller things, and they've often go together, but they don't have to. And I think we can see that in the case of, say, you know, reductionism in social sciences or something, where you might say, oh, well, I want to explain the macro economy in terms of the micro economy. But you're not thinking I'm explaining something that's spatially large in terms of something that's spatially small. That's not the point. So I completely agree that we should separate that kind of reductionism from the reductionism that says it's about smaller little bits of stuff. And that's in part why I was talking about energy scale versus length scale sort of coming apart as well. So it seems quite often in science we have things that coincide and we end up thinking they must always coincide, and then we come across a new situation in which they come apart. I mean, that's interesting in relation to consciousness, because we're used to having consciousness and self-consciousness and the self and, you know, all the highfalutin stuff that we associate with the human intelligence and so on. And we might want to have separate concepts of some of those things and realize that we can have one without the other. So we might say, for example, well, with AI, we've got intelligence without consciousness, maybe. Or with very primitive organisms, we've got intelligence without consciousness. Because bacteria seem to be intelligent in the sense of learning from experience and making decisions in novel environments or whatever, but we probably don't want to say they're conscious.
On this discussion which came up earlier about the unobservable, something we were talking about with Sabina, and then earlier on you were saying, well, whatever floats your boat, if you want to think there's a big one or there's something behind the scenes, an essence to it all, then go for it if you do. Do you not see this as a, you know, a valuable way of sort of putting things like that, which are mysteries, into that unobservable? So it's got to fit somewhere, so it's probably in that place.
Yeah, I sort of wonder really if we've made it, have we advanced with a mystery when we sort of name something or invent a word? I think not. I suppose, you know, you advance when you kind of get more detail, you can be predictive, you can break things down, you can see. And certainly I think that's what science, so that science, we have to have the discipline of empirical evidence for science. I don't think Sabine means by observable to the human senses, right? I think
no,
means
just
detectable, yeah. Like something we can measure, you know, empirical consequences.
Yeah.
I have a question for James. Is that okay if I jump?
Yeah.
Like, do you think it's important to find out what is fundamental? Because you pointed out, not correctly, that particles are not fundamental. And that's what we learn in quantum field theory and curved space-time and so on, that fields are fundamental. But sort of understanding that allows us to, to progress in our theories, right? So do you think it's important to find out what's fundamental?
Sure, but I suppose what I was trying to get at, and maybe I didn't put it so well, I maybe put it more clearly by saying it's not clear to me that there's a single sense of fundamental. So one sense of fundamental that we've already got is something like the parts. You might think, well, the parts are more fundamental than the whole. And then you might have another sense where you think, well, the fundamental is the smaller. And then you've got another sense which is like the fundamental is what we find at the highest energies. And those things might come apart. And so up to now, we tended to be fundamental in one sense is also fundamental in the others, but okay. Maybe not.
But I would disagree that that's fundamental, no? Because if you say like, okay, this is, so for example, again, particles are fundamental, but that, I mean, if there's many fundamentals, there is in a way no fundamental, no?
Well, there's definitely smaller length scale and there's definitely higher energy. And then I think the word fundamental is an interesting one, because philosophers talk all the time about, you know, the fundamental level, the fundamental. And you might think, oh, it's just philosophers. And then you listen to scientists, and they can't talk for long without using the word fundamental. I mean, they say it a lot, but they sometimes mean quite different things, right? So sometimes they mean something like conceptually fundamental.
Yeah.
And sometimes they mean something like, well, this is something you've got to learn first, right? And other times they mean it in this more metaphysical sense. But I think we should just pay close attention to what the relevant sense of fundamental is in a given context. Now, here's a further notion of fundamental. This is most general, right? But a theory maybe could be very general without being fundamental in those other senses. And one example of that might be something like that theory of evolution by natural selection. Because you might think, well, that's such a general theory that would even apply to life in a universe that was different to ours, because it applies to any replicating system that has traits that make a difference to its degree of reproduction that are inheritable. And, you know, if you have such a system, then natural selection applies. And that might be in a way more general than you know, the physics of the actual universe. But it's obviously not a theory of the small scale. So, you know, we can already see maybe that the fundamental in the sense of maximally general is just a different notion of fundamental to fundamental in the sense of description at the smallest length scale.
Sabina, I just want to make sure you've got a chance to come in on this same point. Would you share the same view that James articulated there?
Yeah, totally agree with it. It goes very nicely hand in hand with what I said about the two different types of reductionism. And I don't know about consciousness. I don't want to talk about consciousness. But another nice example of this is David Deutsch's idea of constructor theory. So his idea is basically, to the extent that I understand it, that we can explain much of what we observe about the fundamental laws of nature by postulating that they must be so that we can build universal computers. Mm. So this sounds like, from a particle physicist perspective, totally backwards, because you're starting with this thing, which is a computer that's actually made out of particles, which you would assume are the more fundamental thing. But he says, no, it's all about what we can do with these particles that determine something about what the laws, the underlying laws, must have been. So I find this an interesting example where actually the next deeper level, in some sense, is at large scales, at the devices that we can build from the constituents, which is kind of similar to this idea that we need to talk about consciousness is something that comes together from many particles.
No, I tell you why I like to talk about consciousness, because it's like the elephant in the room in a way, right? I mean, we all have it, and somehow physicists are not supposed to talk about it, and we all kind of walk around it and we're afraid of it. And so I like it because it makes us think further, you know, it makes us think different. It's like the sore thing that I think that is thought provoking. And that's why I actually like to talk about it. But I have no answers to it.
You still haven't put the head on.
Thank you.
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.